Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
If you want jazz music, go to New Orleans. Bagels, New York. And for psychics, think California Psychics. You want the best, you go to the best. At California Psychics, home of free spirits and open minds, we know better than anyone what makes a good psychic. That's why we guarantee, if your reading isn't life-changing, it's free. Visit CaliforniaPsychics.com and experience the joy of certainty. California Psychics.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. A Country Christmas, Part 1, by Louisa May Alcott. A handful of good life is worth a bushel of learning. Dear Emily, I have a brilliant idea, and at once hastened to share it with you. 3 weeks ago, I came up here to the wilds of Vermont to visit my old aunt, also to get a little quiet and distance in which to survey certain new prospects which have opened before me, and to decide whether I will marry a millionaire, or become a queen of society, or remain the charming Miss Vaughan, and wait till the conquering hero comes. Aunt Plummy begs me to stay over Christmas, and I've consented, as I always dread the formal dinner with which my guardian celebrates the day. My brilliant idea is this. I'm going to make it a real old-fashioned frolic, and won't you come and help me? You will enjoy it immensely, I am sure, for Aunt is a character, Cousin Saul worth seeing, and Ruth a far prettier girl than any of the city rosebuds coming out this season. Bring Leonard Randall along with you to take notes for his new books. Then it will be fresher and truer than the last, clever as it was. The air is delicious up here, society amusing, this old farmhouse full of treasures, and your bosom friend pining to embrace you. Just telegraph yes or no, and we will expect you on Tuesday. Ever yours, Sophie Vaughan. They will both come, for they are as tired of city life and as fond of change as I am, said the writer of the above, as she folded her letter and went to get it posted without delay. Aunt Plummy was in the great kitchen making pies, a jolly old soul with a face as ruddy as a winter apple, a cheery voice, and the kindest heart that ever beat under a gingham gown. Pretty Ruth was chopping the mince, and singing so gaily as she worked, that the 24 immortal blackbirds could not have put more music into a pie than she did. Saul was piling wood into the big oven, and Sophie paused a moment on the threshold to look at him, for she always enjoyed the sight of this stalwart cousin, whom she likened to a Norse Viking, with his fair hair and beard, keen blue eyes, and 6 feet of manly height, with shoulders that looked broad and strong enough to bear any burden. His back was toward her, but he saw her first, and turned his flushed face to meet her, with the sudden lighting up it always showed when she approached. "I've done it, Aunt, and now I want Saul to post the letter, so we can get a speedy answer."
"Just as soon as I can hitch up, cousin,
and Saul pitched in his last log, looking ready to put a girdle round the earth in less than 40 minutes. "Well, dear, I ain't the least mite of objection, as long as it pleases you. I guess we can stand it if your city folk can. I presume to say things will look kind of singler to 'em, but I s'pose that's what they come for. Idle folks do dreadful queer things to amuse 'em." And Aunt Plumy leaned on the rolling pin to smile and nod with a shrewd twinkle of her eye, as if she enjoyed the prospect as much as Sophie did.
"I shall be afraid of 'em, but I'll try not to make you ashamed of me," said Ruth, who loved her charming cousin even more than she admired her.
"No fear of that, dear. They will be the awkward ones, and you must set them at ease by just being your simple selves and treating them as if they were everyday people. Nell is very nice and jolly when she drops her city ways, as she must here. She will enter into the spirit of the fun at once, and I know you'll all like her. Mr. Randall is rather the worse for too much praise and petting, as successful people are apt to be, so a little plain talk and rough work will do him good. He is a true gentleman in spite of his airs and elegance, and he will take it all in good part if you treat him like a man and not a lion."
"I'll see to him," said Saul, who had listened with great interest to the latter part of Sophie's speech, evidently suspecting a lover, and enjoying the idea of supplying him with a liberal amount of plain talk and rough work.
"I'll keep 'em busy if that's what they need, for there will be a sight to do, and we can't get help easy up here, for darters don't hire out much, work to home till they marry, and don't go gaddin' round getting their heads full of foolish notions, and forgetting all the useful things their mothers taught 'em."
Aunt Plumy glanced at Ruth as she spoke, and a sudden color in the girl's cheeks proved that the words hit certain ambitious fancies of this pretty daughter of the house of Bassett.
"They shall do their parts and not be a trouble. I'll see to that, for you certainly are the dearest aunt in the world to let me take possession of you and yours in this way," cried Sophie, embracing the old lady with warmth.
Saul wished the embrace could be returned by proxy, as his mother's hands were too flowery to do more than hover affectionately round the delicate face that looked so fresh and young beside her wrinkled one. As it could not be done, he fled temptation and hitched up without delay. The three women laid their heads together in his absence, and Sophie's plan grew apace, for Ruth longed to see a real novelist and a fine lady, and Aunt Plumy, having plans of her own to further, said, "Yes, dear," to every suggestion. Great was the arranging and adorning that went on that day in the old farmhouse, for Sophie wanted her friends to enjoy this taste of country pleasures, and knew just what additions would be indispensable to their comfort, what simple ornaments would be in keeping with the rustic stage on which she meant to play the part of prima donna. Next day a telegram arrived accepting the invitation for both the lady and the lion. They would arrive that afternoon, as little preparation was needed for this impromptu journey, the novelty of which was its chief charm to these blasé people. Saul wanted to get out the double sleigh and span, for he prided himself on his horses, and a fall of snow came most opportunely to beautify the landscape and add a new pleasure to Christmas festivities. But Sophie declared that the old yellow sleigh with Punch, the farm horse, must be used, as she wished everything to be in keeping. And Saul obeyed, thinking he had never seen anything prettier than his cousin when she appeared in his mother's old-fashioned camlet cloak and blue silk pumpkin hood. He looked remarkably well himself in his fur coat, with hair and beard brushed till they shone like spun gold, a fresh color in his cheek, and the sparkle of amusement in his eyes, while excitement gave his usually grave face
the animation it needed to be handsome. Away they jogged in the creaking old sleigh, leaving Ruth to make herself pretty with a fluttering heart, and Aunt Plummy to dish up a late dinner fit to tempt the most fastidious appetite.
"She has not come for us, and there is not even a stage to take us up. There must be some mistake," said Emily Herrick, as she looked about the shabby little station where they were set down.
"That is the never-to-be-forgotten face of our fair friend, but the bonnet of her grandmother, if my eyes do not deceive me," answered Randall, turning to survey the couple approaching in the rear.
"Sophie Vaughan, what do you mean by making such a guy of yourself?" exclaimed Emily, as she kissed the smiling face in the hood and stared at the quaint cloak.
"I'm dressed for my part, and I intend to keep it up. This is our host, my cousin, Saul Bassett. Come to the sleigh at once. He will see to your luggage," said Sophie, painfully conscious of the antiquity of her array as her eyes rested on Emily's pretty hat and mantle, and the masculine elegance of Randall's wraps. They were hardly tucked in when Saul appeared with a valise in one hand and a large trunk on his shoulder, swinging both on to a wood sled that stood nearby as easily as if they had been handbags.
"That is your hero, is it? Well, he looks it, calm and comely, taciturn and tall," said Emily, in a tone of approbation.
"He should have been named Samson or Goliath, though I believe it was the small man who slung things about and turned out the hero in the end," added Randall, surveying the performance with interest and a touch of envy, for much pen work had made his own hands as delicate as a woman's.
"Saul doesn't live in a glass house, so stones won't hurt him. Remember, sarcasm is forbidden, and sincerity the order of the day. You are country folks now, and it will do you good to try their simple, honest ways for a few days." Sophie had no time to say more, for Saul came up and drove off with the brief remark that the baggage would be along right away. Being hungry, cold, and tired, the guests were rather silent during the short drive, but Aunt Plummy's hospitable welcome and the savory fumes of the dinner awaiting them thawed the ice and won their hearts at once.
"Isn't it nice? Aren't you glad you came?" asked Sophie, as she led her friends into the parlor, which she had redeemed from its primness by putting bright chintz curtains to the windows, hemlock boughs over the old portraits, a china bowl of flowers on the table, and a splendid fire on the wide hearth.
"It is perfectly jolly, and this is the way I begin to enjoy myself," answered Emily, sitting down upon the homemade rug, whose red flannel roses bloomed in a blue list basket.
"If I may add a little smoke to your glorious fire, it will be quite perfect. Won't Samson join me?" asked Randall, waiting for permission, cigar case in hand.
"He has no small vices, but you may indulge yours," answered Sophie from the depths of a grandmotherly chair.
Emily glanced up at her friend as if she caught a new tone in her voice, then turned to the fire again with a wise little nod, as if confiding some secret to the reflection of herself in the bright brass Anderon.
"His Delilah does not take this form. I wait with interest to discover if he has one. What a daisy the sister is! Does she ever speak?" asked Randall, trying to lounge on the haircloth sofa, where he was slipping uncomfortably about.
"Oh, yes, and sings like a bird. You shall hear her when she gets over her shyness. But no trifling, mind you, for it is a jealously guarded daisy, and not to be picked by any idle hand," said Sophie warningly, as she recalled Ruth's blushes and Randall's compliments at dinner.
I should expect to be annihilated by the big brother if I attempted any but the sincerest admiration and respect. Have no fears on that score, but tell us what is to follow this superb dinner. An Appleby, spinning match, husking party, or a primitive pastime of some sort, I have no doubt.
As you are new to our ways, I am going to let you rest this evening. We will sit about the fire and tell stories. Aunt is a master hand at that, and Saul has reminiscences of the war that are well worth hearing, if we can only get him to tell them.
Ah, he was there, was he?
Yes, all through it, and is Major Bassett, though he likes his plain name best. He fought splendidly and had several wounds, though only a mere boy when he earned his scars and bars. I'm very proud of him for that. And Sophie looked so as she glanced at the photograph of a stripling in uniform set in the place of honor on the high mantelpiece.
We must stir him up and hear these martial memories. I want some new incidents, and shall book all I can get, if I may.
Here Randall was interrupted by Saul himself, who came in with an armful of wood for the fire.
"Anything more I can do for you, cousin?" he asked, surveying the scene with a rather wistful look.
"Only come and sit with us, and talk over war times with Mr. Randall."
"When I've foddered the cattle and done my chores, I'd be pleased to." "What regiment were you in?" asked Saul, looking down from his lofty height upon the slender gentleman, who answered briefly,
"In none. I was abroad at the time."
"Sick?"
"No, busy with a novel."
"Took 4 years to write it?"
"I was obliged to travel and study before I could finish it. These things take more time to work up than outsiders would believe."
"Seems to me our war was a finer story than any you could find in Europe, and the best way to study it would be to fight it out. If you want heroes and heroines, you'd have found plenty of 'em there."
"I have no doubt of it, and shall be glad to atone for my seeming neglect of them by hearing about your own exploits, Major."
Randall hoped to turn the conversation gracefully, but Saul was not to be caught, and left the room saying with a gleam of fun in his eye,
"I can't stop now. Heroes can wait. Pigs can't."
The girls laughed at this sudden descent from the sublime to the ridiculous, and Randall joined them, feeling his condescension had not been unobserved. End of part one.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. A Country Christmas, Part 2, by Louisa May Alcott. As if drawn by the merry sound, Aunt Plummy appeared, and being established in the rocking chair, fell to talking as easily as if she had known her guests for years.
"Laugh away, young folks. That's better for digestion than any of the messes people use. Are you troubled with dyspepsy, dear? You didn't seem to take your victuals very hearty, so I mistrusted you was delicate," she said, looking at Emily, whose pale cheeks and weary eyes told the story of late hours and a gay life.
"I haven't eaten so much for years, I assure you, Mrs. Bassett. But it was impossible to taste all your good things. I am not dyspeptic, thank you, but a little seedy and tired, for I've been working rather hard lately."
"Be you a teacher, or have you a profession, as they call a trade nowadays?" asked the old lady in a tone of kindly interest,
which prevented a laugh at the idea of Emily's being anything but a beauty and a belle. The others kept their countenances with difficulty, and she answered demurely,
"I have no trade as yet, but I dare say I should be happier if I had."
"Not a doubt on it, my dear."
"What would you recommend, ma'am?"
"I should say dressmakin' was rather in your line, ain't it? Your clothes is dreadful tasty, and do you credit if you made 'em yourself?"
And Aunt Plumy surveyed with feminine interest the simple elegance of the travelling dress which was the masterpiece of a French modiste.
"No, ma'am, I don't make my own things. I'm too lazy. It takes so much time and trouble to select them that I have only strength left to wear them."
"Housekeepin' used to be the favorite profession in my day. It ain't fashionable now, but it needs a sight of training to be perfect in all that's required, and I've an idea it would be a sight healthier and usefuller than the paintin' and music and fancy work young women do nowadays."
"But everyone wants some beauty in their lives, and each one has a different sphere to fill, if one can only find it. 'Pears to me there's no call for so much art when natter is full of beauty for them that can see and love it. As for spears and so on, I've a notion if each of us did up our own little chore smart and thorough, we needn't go wandering round to set the world to rights. That's the Lord's job, and I presume to say he can do it without any advice of ourn."
Something in the homely but true words seemed to rebuke the three listeners for wasted lives, and for a moment there was no sound but the crackle of the fire, the brisk click of the old lady's knitting needles, and Ruth's voice singing overhead as she made ready to join the party below.
"To judge by that sweet sound, you have done one of your chores very beautifully, Mrs. Bassett, and in spite of the follies of our day, succeeded in keeping one girl healthy, happy, and unspoiled," said Emily, looking up into the peaceful old face with her own lovely one full of respect and envy.
"I do hope so, for she's my ewe lamb, the last of four dear little girls. All the rest are in the burying ground side of father. I don't expect to keep her long, and don't ought to regret when I lose her, for Saul is the best of sons, but daughters is more to mothers somehow, and I always yearn over girls that is left without a broodin' wing to keep 'em safe and warm in this world of tribulation."
Aunt Plumy laid her hand on Sophie's head as she spoke, with such a motherly look that both girls drew nearer, and Randall resolved to put her in a book without delay. Presently, Saul returned with little Ruth hanging on his arm, and shyly nestling near him as he took the three-cornered leathern chair in the chimney nook, while she sat on a stool close by.
"Now the circle is complete and the picture perfect. Don't light the lamps yet, please, but talk away and let me make a mental study of you. I seldom find so charming a scene to paint,"
said Randall, beginning to enjoy himself immensely, with a true artist's taste for novelty and effect.
"Tell us about your book, for we have been reading it as it comes out in the magazine, and are much exercised about how it's going to end," began Saul, gallantly throwing himself into the breach, for a momentary embarrassment fell upon the women at the idea of sitting for their portraits before they were ready.
"Do you really read my poor serial up here, and do me the honor to like it?" asked the novelist, both flattered and amused, for his work was of the aesthetic sort, microscopic studies of character and careful pictures of modern life.
"Sakes alive! Why shouldn't we?" cried Aunt Plumy. "We have some education, though we ain't very genteel. We've got a town library,
kept up by the women mostly, with fairs and tea parties and so on. We have all the magazines regular, and Saul reads out the pieces while Ruth sews and I knit, my eyes being poor. Our winter is long, and evenings would be kinder lonesome if we didn't have novels and newspapers to cheer 'em up.
I'm very glad I can help to beguile them for you. Now tell me what you honestly think of my work. Criticism is always valuable, and I should really like yours, Mrs. Bassett, said Randall, wondering what the good woman would make of the delicate analysis and worldly wisdom on which he prided himself. Short work, as Aunt Plumy soon showed him, for she rather enjoyed freeing her mind at all times, and decidedly resented the insinuation that country folk could not appreciate light literature as well as city people.
"I ain't no great of a jedge about anything but naturalness of books, and it really does seem as if some of your men and women was dreadful uncomfortable critters. 'Pears to me it ain't wise to be always picking ourselves to pieces and prying into things that ought to come gradual by way of experience and the visitations of Providence. Flowers won't blow worth a cent if you pull 'em open. Better wait and see what they can do alone. I do relish the smart sayings, the odd ways of furrin parts, and the sarcastic slaps at folks' weak spots. But Massey knows we can't live on spice cake and Charlotte Russe, and I do feel as if books was more sustainin' if they was full of everyday people and things, like good bread and butter. Them that goes to the heart and ain't soon forgotten is the kind I hanker for. Miss Terry's books now, and Miss Stowe's, and Dickens' Christmas pieces. Them is real sweet and cheering to my mind.' As the blunt old lady paused, it was evident she had produced a sensation, for Saul smiled at the fire, Ruth looked dismayed at this assault upon one of her idols, and the young ladies were both astonished and amused at the keenness of the new critic who dared express what they had often felt. Randall, however, was quite composed and laughed good-naturedly, though secretly feeling as if a pail of cold water had been poured over him.
"Many thanks, madam. You have discovered my weak point with surprising accuracy. But you see I cannot help picking folks to pieces, as you have expressed it. That is my gift, and it has its attractions, as the sale of my books will testify. People like the spice bread, and as that is the only sort my oven will bake, I must keep on in order to make my living."
"So rumsellers say, but it ain't a good trade to foller, and I'd chop wood for I'd earn my living harmin' my feller man. 'Pears to me, I'd let my oven cool a spell, and hunt up some homely, happy folks to write about. Folks that don't borrow trouble and go looking for holes in their neighbors' coats, but take their lives brave and cheerful. And remembering, we are all human, have pity on the weak, and try to be as full of mercy, patience, and loving-kindness as Him who made us. That sort of a book would do a heap of good, be real warmin' and strengthening, and make them that read it love the man that wrote it, and remember him when he was dead and gone."
"I wish I could." And Randall meant what he said, for he was as tired of his own style as a watchmaker might be of the magnifying glass through which he strains his eyes all day. He knew that the heart was left out of his work, and that both mind and soul were growing morbid with dwelling on the faulty, absurd, and metaphysical phases of life and character. He often threw down his pen and vowed he would write no more. But he loved ease, and the books brought money readily. He was accustomed to the stimulant of praise, and missed it as a toper misses his wine. So that which had once been a pleasure to himself and others
was fast becoming a burden and a disappointment. The brief pause which followed his involuntary betrayal of discontent was broken by Ruth, who exclaimed, with a girlish enthusiasm that overpowered girlish bashfulness,
"I think all the novels are splendid. I hope you will write hundreds more, and I shall live to read 'em."
"Bravo, my gentle champion. I promise that I will write one more at least, and have a heroine in it whom your mother will both admire and love," answered Randall, surprised to find how grateful he was for the girl's approval, and how rapidly his trained fancy began to paint the background on which he hoped to copy this fresh human daisy. Abashed by her involuntary outburst, Ruth tried to face herself behind Saul's broad shoulder, and he brought the conversation back to its starting point by saying in a tone of the most sincere interest,
"Speaking of the serial, I am very anxious to know how your hero comes out. He's a fine fellow, and I can't decide whether he is going to spoil his life marrying that silly woman, or do something grand and generous, and not be made a fool of."
"Upon my soul, I don't know myself. It is very hard to find new finales. Can't you suggest something, Major? And then I shall not be obliged to leave my story without an end, as people complained I am rather fond of doing."
"Well, no, I don't think I've anything to offer. Seems to me it isn't the sensational exploits that show the hero best, but some great sacrifice quietly made by a common sort of man who is noble without knowing it. I saw a good many such during the war, and often wish I could write them down, for it is surprising how much courage, goodness, and real piety is stowed away in common folks, ready to show when the right time comes."
"Tell us of them, and I'll bless you for a hint. No one knows the anguish of an author's spirit when he can't ring down the curtain on an effective tableau," said Randall, with a glance at his friends to ask their aid in eliciting an anecdote or reminiscence.
"Tell about the splendid fellow who had the bridge, like Horatius, till help came. That was a thrilling story, I assure you," answered Sophie, with an inviting smile.
But Saul would not be his own hero, and said briefly,
"Any man can be brave when the battle fever is on him, and it only takes a little physical courage to dash ahead."
He paused a moment, with his eyes on the snowy landscape without, where twilight was deepening. Then, as if constrained by the memory that winter scene evoked, he slowly continued,
"One of the bravest things I ever knew was done by a poor fellow who had been a hero to me ever since, though I only met him that night. It was after one of the big battles of that last winter, and I was knocked over with a broken leg and two or three bullets here and there. Night was coming on, snow falling, and a sharp wind blew over the field where a lot of us lay, dead and alive, waiting for the ambulance to come and pick us up. There was a skirmishing going on not far off, and our prospects were rather poor between frost and fire. I was calculating how I'd manage when I found two poor chaps close by who were worse off, so I braced up and did what I could for them. One had an arm blown away and kept up a dreadful groaning. The other was shot bad, and bleeding to death for want of help, but never complained. He was nearest, and I liked his pluck, for he spoke cheerful and made me ashamed to growl. Sometimes make dreadful brutes of men, if they haven't something to hold on to, and all three of us were most wild with pain and cold and hunger, for we'd fought all day fasting, when we heard a rumble in the road below, and saw lanterns bobbing round.
That meant life to us. And we all tried to holler. Two of us were pretty faint, but I managed a good yell, and they heard it. "Room for one more. Hard luck, old boys, but we are full and must save the worst wounded first. Take a drink and hold on till we come back," says one of them, with a stretcher. "Here's the one to go," I says, pointing out my man, for I saw by the light that he was hard hit. "No, that one. He's got more chances than I, or this one. He's young and got a mother. I'll wait," said the good feller, touching my arm, for he'd heard me muttering to myself about this dear old lady. We always want mother when we are down, you know. Saul's eyes turned to the beloved face with a glance of tenderest affection, and Aunt Plummy answered with a dismal groan at the recollection of his need that night and her absence. Well, to be short, the groaning chap was taken and my man left. I was mad, but there was no time for talk, and the selfish one went off and left that poor feller to run his one chance. I had my rifle, and guessed I could hobble up to use it if need be. So we settled back to wait without much hope of help, everything being in a muddle. And wait we did till morning, for that ambulance did not come back till next day, when most of us were past needing it. I'll never forget that night. I dream it all over again as plain as if it was real. Snow, cold, darkness, hunger, thirst, pain, and all round us cries and cursing, growing less and less, till at last only the wind went moaning over that meadow. It was awful. So lonesome, helpless, and seemingly God-forsaken. Hour after hour we lay there, side by side under one coat, waiting to be saved or die, for the wind grew strong and we grew weak. Saul drew a long breath and held his hands to the fire, as if he felt again the sharp suffering of that night. "And the man?" asked Emily, softly, as if reluctant to break the silence. "He was a man. In times like that, men talk like brothers and show what they are. Lying there, slowly freezing, Joe Cummings told me about his wife and babies, his old folks waiting for him, all depending on him, yet all ready to give him up when he was needed. A plain man, but honest and true and loving as a woman. I soon saw that he went on talking, half to me and half to himself, for sometimes he wandered a little toward the end. I've read books, heard sermons, and seen good folks, but nothing ever came so close or did me so much good as seeing this man die. He had one chance, and gave it cheerfully. He longed for those he loved, and let him go with a goodbye they couldn't hear. He suffered all the pains we most shrink from, without a murmur, and kept my heart warm while his own was growing cold. It's no use trying to tell that part of it. But I heard prayers that night that meant something, and I saw how faith could hold a soul up when everything was gone but God." Saul stopped there with a sudden huskiness in his deep voice, and when he went on, it was in the tone of one who speaks of a dear friend. "Joe grew still by and by, and I thought he was asleep, for I felt his breath when I tucked him up, and his hand held on to mine. The cold sort of numbed me, and I dropped off, too weak and stupid to think or feel. I never should have waked up if it hadn't been for Joe. When I came to, it was morning, and I thought I was dead, for all I could see was that great field of white mounds like graves, and a splendid sky above. Then I looked for Joe, remembering, but he had put my coat back over me. and lay stiff and still under the snow that covered him like a shroud, all except his face. A bit of my cape had blown over it, and when I took it off, and the sun shone on his dead face, I declare to you, it was so full of heavenly peace, I felt as if that common man had been glorified by God's light, and rewarded by God's well done. That's all. No one spoke for a moment, while the women wiped their eyes and Saul dropped his as if to hide something softer than tears. It was very noble, very touching. And you? How did you get off at last? Asked Randall, with real admiration and respect in his usually languid face. Crawled off, answered Saul, relapsing into his former brevity of speech. Why not before and save yourself all that misery? Couldn't leave Joe. I see. There were two heroes that night. Dozens, I've no doubt. Those were times that made heroes of men and women, too.
Tell us more, begged Emily, looking up with an expression none of her admirers ever brought to her face by their softest compliments or wiliest gossip.
I've done my part. It's Mr. Randall's turn now. And Saul drew himself out of the ruddy circle of firelight, as if ashamed of the prominent part he was playing. Sophie and her friend had often heard Randall talk, for he was an accomplished raconteur, but that night he exerted himself and was unusually brilliant and entertaining, as if upon his mettle. The Bassetts were charmed. They sat late and were very merry, for Aunt Plummy got up a little supper for them, and her cider was as exhilarating as champagne. When they parted for the night, and Sophie kissed her aunt, Emily did the same, saying heartily,
"It seems as if I'd known you all my life, and this is certainly the most enchanting old place that ever was."
"Glad you like it, dear, but it ain't all fun, as you'll find out tomorrow when you go to work, for Sophie says you must," answered Mrs. Bassett, as her guests trooped away, rashly promising to like everything. End of part 2.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. A Country Christmas, Part 3, by Louisa May Alcott. They found it difficult to keep their word when they were called at 6:30 next morning. Their rooms were warm, however, and they managed to scramble down in time for breakfast, guided by the fragrance of coffee and Aunt Plummy's shrill voice singing the good old hymn, "Lord, in the morning thou shalt hear my voice ascending high." An open fire blazed on the hearth, for the cooking was done in the lean-to, and the spacious, sunny kitchen was kept in all its old-fashioned perfection, with the wooden settle in a warm nook, the tall clock behind the door, copper and pewter utensils shining on the dresser, old china in the corner closet, and a little spinning wheel rescued from the garret by Sophie to adorn the deep window full of scarlet geraniums, Christmas roses, and white chrysanthemums. The young lady, in a checkered apron and mop cap, greeted her friends with a dish of buckwheats in one hand and a pair of cheeks that proved she had been learning to fry these delicate cakes.
"You do keep it up in earnest, upon my word, and very becoming it is, dear.
"But won't you ruin your complexion and roughen your hands if you do so much of this new fancy work?" asked Emily, much amazed at this novel freak. "I like it, and really believe I've found my proper sphere at last. Domestic life seems so pleasant to me that I feel as if I'd better keep it up for the rest of my life," answered Sophie, making a pretty picture of herself as she cut great slices of brown bread, with the early sunshine touching her happy face.
"The charming Miss Vaughan, in the role of a farmer's wife. I find it difficult to imagine, and shrink from the thought of the widespread dismay such a fate will produce among her adorers," added Randall, as he basked in the glow of the hospitable fire.
"She might do worse, but come to breakfast and do honor to my handiwork," said Sophie, thinking of her worn-out millionaire, and rather nettled by the satiric smile on Randall's lips.
"What an appetite early rising gives one! I feel equal to almost anything, so let me help wash cups," said Emily, with unusual energy, when the hearty meal was over, and Sophie began to pick up the dishes as if it was her usual work. Ruth went to the window to water the flowers, and Randall followed to make himself agreeable, remembering her defense of him last night. He was used to admiration from feminine eyes, and flattery from soft lips, but found something new and charming in the innocent delight which showed itself at his approach, in blushes more eloquent than words, and shy glances from eyes full of hero worship. "I hope you are going to spare me a posy for tomorrow night, since I can be fine in no other way to do honor to the dance Miss Sophie proposes for us," he said, leaning in the bay window to look down on the little girl with the devoted air he usually wore for pretty women.
"Anything you like. I should be so glad to have you wear my flowers. There will be enough for all, and I've nothing else to give to people who have made me as happy as Cousin Sophie and you," answered Ruth, half drowning her great calla as she spoke with grateful warmth.
"You must make her happy by accepting the invitation to go home with her, which I heard given last night. A peep at the world would do you good, and be a pleasant change, I think."
"Oh, very pleasant. But would it do me good?" And Ruth looked up with sudden seriousness in her blue eyes, as a child questions an elder, eager, yet wistful.
"Why not?"
asked Randall, wondering at the hesitation. "I might grow discontented with things here if I saw splendid houses and fine people. I am very happy now, and it would break my heart to lose that happiness, or ever learn to be ashamed of home."
"But don't you long for more pleasure, new scenes, and other friends than these?" asked the man, touched by the little creature's loyalty to the things she knew and loved.
"Very often, but mother says when I'm ready they will come, so I wait, and try not to be impatient." But Ruth's eyes looked out over the green leaves as if the longing was very strong within her to see more of the unknown world lying beyond the mountains that hemmed her in.
"It is natural for birds to hop out of the nest, so I shall expect to see you over there before long, and ask you how you enjoy your first flight," said Randall, in a paternal tone that had a curious effect on Ruth.
To his surprise, she laughed, then blushed like one of her own roses, and answered with a demure dignity that was very pretty to see. "I intend to hop soon, but it won't be a very long flight, or very far from Mother. She can't spare me, and nobody in the world can fill her place to me."
"Bless the child, does she think I'm going to make love to her?" thought Randall, much amused but quite mistaken.
Wiser women had thought so when he assumed the caressing air with which he beguiled them into the little revelations of character he liked to use,
as the south wind makes flowers open their hearts to give up their odor, then leaves them to carry it elsewhere, the more welcome for the stolen sweetness.
Perhaps you are right. The maternal wing is a safe shelter for confiding little souls like you, Miss Ruth. You will be as comfortable here as your flowers in this sunny window, he said, carelessly pinching geranium leaves and ruffling the roses till the pink petals of the largest fluttered to the floor. As if she instinctively felt and resented something in the man which his act symbolized, the girl answered quietly, as she went on with her work.
Yes, if the frost does not touch me, or careless people spoil me too soon.
Before Randall could reply, Aunt Plummy approached like a maternal hen who sees her chicken in danger.
"Saul is going to haul wood after he's done his chores. Maybe you'd like to go along? The view is good, the road's well broke, and the day uncommon fine."
"Thanks. It will be delightful, I dare say," politely responded the lion, with a secret shudder at the idea of a rural promenade at 8 a.m. in the winter. "Come on, then. We'll feed the stock, and then I'll show you how to yoke oxen," said Saul, with a twinkle in his eye as he led the way, when his new aide had muffled himself up, as if for a polar voyage.
"Now that's too bad of Saul. He did it on purpose, just to please you, Sophie," cried Ruth presently, and the girls ran to the window to behold Randall bravely following his host with a pail of pig's food in each hand and an expression of resigned disgust upon his aristocratic face.
"To what base use may we come?" quoted Emily, as they all nodded and smiled upon the victim as he looked back from the barnyard, where he was clamorously welcomed by his new charges.
"It is rather a shock at first, but it will do him good, and Saul won't be too hard upon him, I'm sure," said Sophie, going back to her work while Ruth turned her best buds to the sun, that they might be ready for a peace offering tomorrow. There was a merry clatter in the big kitchen for an hour. Then Aunt Plummy and her daughter shut themselves up in the pantry to perform some culinary rites, and the young ladies went to inspect certain antique costumes laid forth in Sophie's room.
"You see, Em, I thought it would be appropriate to the house and season to have an old-fashioned dance. Aunt has quantities of ancient finery stowed away, for great-grandfather Bassett was a fine old gentleman, and his family lived in state. Take your choice of the crimson, blue, or silver-gray damask. Ruth is to wear the worked muslin and quilted white satin skirt, with that coquettish hat.
Being dark, I'll take the red and trim it up with this fine lace. You must wear the blue and primrose with the distracting high-heeled shoes. Have you any suits for the men?" asked Emily, throwing herself at once into the all-absorbing matter of costume.
"A claret velvet coat and vest, silk stockings, cocked hat, and snuff box for Randall. Nothing large enough for Saul, so he must wear his uniform. Won't Aunt Plummy be superb in this plum-colored satin and immense cap?"
A delightful morning was spent in adapting the faded finery of the past to the blooming beauty of the present, and time and tongues flew till the toot of a horn called them down to dinner. The girls were amazed to see Randall come whistling up the road with his trousers tucked into his boots, blue mittens on his hands, and an unusual amount of energy in his whole figure as he drove the oxen, while Saul laughed at his vain attempts to guide the bewildered beasts.
"It's immense. The view from the hill is well worth seeing, for the snow glorifies the landscape and reminds one of Switzerland. I'm going to make a sketch of it this afternoon. Better come and enjoy the delicious freshness, young ladies,"
Randall was eating with such an appetite that he did not see the glances the girls exchanged as they promised to go.
"Bring home some more wintergreen. I want things to be real nice, and we haven't enough for the kitchen," said Ruth, dimpling with girlish delight as she imagined herself dancing under the green garlands in her grandmother's wedding gown. It was very lovely on the hill, for far as the eye could reach lay the wintry landscape, sparkling with the brief beauty of sunshine on virgin snow. Pines sighed overhead, hardy birds flitted to and fro, and in all the trodden spots rose the little spires of evergreen, ready for its Christmas duty. Deeper in the wood sounded the measured ring of axes, the crash of falling trees, while the red shirts of the men added color to the scene, and a fresh wind brought the aromatic breath of newly cloven hemlock and pine.
"How beautiful it is! I never knew before what winter woods were like. Did you, Sophie?" asked Emily, sitting on a stump to enjoy the novel pleasure at her ease.
"I found out lately. Saul lets me come as often as I like, and this fine air seems to make a new creature of me," answered Sophie, looking about her with sparkling eyes as if this was a kingdom where she reigned supreme.
"Something is making a new creature of you. That is very evident. I haven't yet discovered whether it is the air or some magic herb among that green stuff you are gathering so diligently,"
and Emily laughed to see the color deepen beautifully in her friend's half-averted face.
"Scarlet is the only wear just now, I find. If we are lost like babes in the woods, there are plenty of redbreasts to cover us with leaves."
And Randall joined Emily's laugh with a glance at Saul, who had just pulled his coat off.
"You wanted to see this tree go down, so stand from under, and I'll show you how it's done," said the farmer, taking up his axe, not unwilling to gratify his guests and display his manly accomplishments at the same time.
It was a fine sight, the stalwart man swinging his axe with magnificent strength and skill, each blow sending a thrill through the stately tree, till its heart was reached and it tottered to its fall. Now, pausing for breath, Saul shook his yellow mane out of his eyes and hewed away, while the drops stood on his forehead and his arm ached, as bent on distinguishing himself as if he had been a knight tilting against his rival for his lady's favor.
"I don't know which to admire most, the man or his muscle. One doesn't often see such vigor, size, and comeliness in these degenerate days," said Randall, mentally booking the fine figure in the red shirt. "I think we have discovered a rough diamond. I only wonder if Sophie is going to try and polish it," answered Emily, glancing at her friend, who stood a little apart, watching the rise and fall of the axe as intently as if her fate depended on it. Down rushed the tree at last, and, leaving them to examine a crow's nest in its branches, Saul went off to his men, as if he found the praises of his prowess rather too much for him. Randall fell to sketching, the girls to their garland making, and for a little while the sunny woodland nook was full of lively chat and pleasant laughter, for the air exhilarated them all like wine. Suddenly a man came running from the wood, pale and anxious, saying, as he hastened by for help,
"Blasted tree fell on him. Bleed to death before the doctor comes."
"Who? Who?"
cried the startled trio. But the man ran on with some breathless reply in which only a name was audible. "Bassett."
"The deuce it is!"
And Randall dropped his pencil while the girl sprang up in dismay. Then, with one impulse, they hastened to the distant group,
half visible behind the fallen trees and corded wood. Sophie was there first, and forcing her way through the little crowd of men, saw a red-shirted figure on the ground, crushed and bleeding, and threw herself down beside it with a cry that pierced the hearts of those who heard it. In the act, she saw it was not Saul, and covered her bewildered face as if to hide its joy. A strong arm lifted her, and the familiar voice said cheeringly,
"I'm all right, dear. Poor Bruce is hurt, but we've sent for help. Better go right home and forget all about it."
"Yes, I will, if I can do nothing." And Sophie meekly returned to her friends, who stood outside the circle over which Saul's head towered, assuring them of his safety. Hoping they had not seen her agitation, she led Emily away, leaving Randall to give what aid he could and bring them news of the poor woodchopper's state. Aunt Plummy produced the camphire the moment she saw Sophie's pale face and made her lie down, while the brave old lady trudged briskly off with bandages and brandy to the scene of action. On her return, she brought comfortable news of the man, so the little flurry blew over and was forgotten by all but Sophie, who remained pale and quiet all the evening, tying evergreen as if her life depended on it. "A good night's sleep will set her up. She ain't used to such things, dear child, and needs cussedin," said Aunt Plummy, purring over her until she was in her bed, with a hot stone at her feet and a bowl of herb tea to quiet her nerves. An hour later, when Emily went up, she peeped in to see if Sophie was sleeping nicely, and was surprised to find the invalid, wrapped in a dressing gown, writing busily.
"Last will and testament, or sudden inspiration, dear? How are you? Faint or feverish, delirious, or in the dumps? Saul looks so anxious, and Mrs. Bassett hushes us all up so. I came to bed, leaving Randall to entertain Ruth." As she spoke, Emily saw the papers disappear in a portfolio, and Sophie rose with a yawn.
"I was writing letters, but I'm sleepy now. Quite over my foolish fright, thank you. Go and get your beauty sleep, that you may dazzle the natives tomorrow."
"So glad. Good night."
And Emily went away, saying to herself,
"Something is going on, and I must find out what it is before I leave. Sophie can't blind me."
But Sophie did all the next day, being delightfully gay at the dinner and devoting herself to the young minister who was invited to meet the distinguished novelist, and evidently, being afraid of him, gladly basked in the smiles of his charming neighbor. A dashing sleigh ride occupied the afternoon, and then great was the fun and excitement over the costumes. Aunt Plummy laughed till the tears rolled down her cheeks as the girls compressed her into the plum-colored gown with its short waist, leg-of-mutton sleeves, and narrow skirt. But a worked scarf hid all the deficiencies, and the towering cap struck awe into the soul of the most frivolous observer.
"Keep an eye on me, girls, for I shall certainly split somewhere or lose my headpiece off when I'm trottin' round. What would my blessed mother say if she could see me rigged out in her best things?"
And with a smile and a sigh, the old lady departed to look after the boys and see that the supper was all right. End of part 3.
Shoes and Stockings, a collection of short stories by Louisa May Alcott. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Carolyn Francis. A Country Christmas, Part 4, by Louisa May Alcott.
Three prettier damsels never tripped down the wide staircase than the brilliant brunette in crimson brocade, the pensive blonde in blue, or the rosy little bride in old muslin and white satin. A gallant court gentleman met them in the hall with a superb bow and escorted them to the parlor, where Grandma Bassett's ghost was discovered dancing with a modern major in full uniform. Mutual admiration and many compliments followed, till other ancient ladies and gentlemen arrived in all manner of queer costumes, and the old house seemed to wake from its humdrum quietude to sudden music and merriment, as if a past generation had returned to keep its Christmas there. The village fiddler soon struck up the good old tunes, and then the strangers saw dancing that filled them with mingled mirth and envy. It was so droll, yet so hearty. The young men, unusually awkward in their grandfather's knee-breeches, flapping vests, and swallow-tail coats, footed it bravely with the buxom girls, who were the prettier for their quaintness, and danced with such vigor that their high combs stood awry, their furbelows waved wildly, and their cheeks were as red as their breast-knots or hose. It was impossible to stand still, and one after the other the city folk yielded to the spell, Randall leading off with Ruth, Sophie swept away by Saul, and Emily being taken possession of by a young giant of 18, who spun her around with a boyish impetuosity that took her breath away. Even Aunt Plummy was discovered jigging it alone in the pantry, as if the music was too much for her, and the plates and glasses jingled gaily on the shelves in time to Monkey Musk and Fisher's Hornpipe. A pause came at last, however, and fans fluttered, heated brows were wiped, jokes were made, lovers exchanged confidences, and every nook and corner held a man and maid carrying on the sweet game which is never out of fashion. There was a glitter of gold lace in the back entry, and a train of blue and primrose shone in the dim light. There was a richer crimson than that of the geraniums in the deep window, and a dainty shoe tapped the bare floor impatiently as the brilliant black eyes looked everywhere for the court gentleman, while their owner listened to the gruff prattle of an enamored boy. But in the upper hall walked a little white ghost, as if waiting for some shadowy companion, and when a dark form appeared, ran to take its arm, saying in a tone of soft satisfaction,
"I was so afraid you wouldn't come."
"Why did you leave me, Ruth?" answered a manly voice in a tone of surprise, though the small hand slipping from the velvet coat sleeve was replaced, as if it was pleasant to feel it there. A pause, and then the other voice answered demurely,
"Because I was afraid my head would be turned by the fine things you were saying."
"It is impossible to help saying what one feels to such an artless little creature as you are. It does me good to admire anything so fresh and sweet, and won't harm you."
"It might, if—"
"If what, my Daisy?"
"I believed it." And a laugh seemed to finish the broken sentence better than the words.
"You may, Ruth. For I do sincerely admire the most genuine girl I have seen for a long time. And walking here with you in your bridal white, I was just asking myself if I should not be a happier man, with a home of my own and a little wife hanging on my arm, than drifting about the world as I do now, with only myself to care for."
"I know you would."
And Ruth spoke so earnestly that Randall was both touched and startled, fearing he had ventured too far in a mood of unwonted sentiment, born of the romance of the hour and the sweet frankness of his companion.
"Then you don't think it would be rash for some sweet woman to take me in hand and make me happy, since fame is a failure?"
"Oh, no. It would be easy work if she loved you. I know someone, if I only dared to tell her name."
"Upon my soul, this is cool." And Randall looked down, wondering if the audacious lady on his arm could be shy Ruth. If he had seen the malicious merriment in her eyes, he would have been more humiliated still. But they were modestly averted, and the face under the little hat was full of a soft agitation, rather dangerous even to a man of the world.
"She is a captivating little creature, but it is too soon for anything but a mild flirtation. I must delay further innocent revelations, or I shall do something rash."
While making this excellent resolution, Randall had been pressing the hand upon his arm and gently pacing down the dimly lighted hall with the sound of music in his ears, Ruth's sweetest roses in his buttonhole, and a loving little girl beside him, as he thought.
"You shall tell me by and by when we are in town. I'm sure you will come, and meanwhile, don't forget me."
"I'm going in the spring, but I shall not be with Sophie," answered Ruth in a whisper.
"With whom, then? I shall long to see you."
"With my husband. I am to be married in May."
"The deuce you are,"
escaped Randall, as he stopped short to stare at his companion, sure she was not in earnest. But she was, for as he looked, the sound of steps coming up the back stairs made her whole face flush and brighten with the unmistakable glow of happy love, and she completed Randall's astonishment by running into the arms of the young minister, saying with an irrepressible laugh,
"Oh, John, why didn't you come before?"
The court gentleman was all right in a moment, and the coolest of the three as he offered his congratulations and gracefully retired, leaving the lovers to enjoy the tryst he had delayed. But as he went downstairs, his brows were knit, and he slapped the broad railing smartly with his cocked hat, as if some irritation must find vent in a more energetic way than merely saying,
"Confound the little baggage," under his breath.
Such an amazing supper came from Aunt Plummy's big pantry that the city guests could not eat for laughing at the queer dishes circulating through the rooms and copiously partaken of by the hearty young folks. Donuts and cheese, pie and pickles, cider and tea, baked beans and custards, cake and cold turkey, bread and butter, plum pudding and French bonbons, Sophie's contribution.
"May I offer you the native delicacies and share your plate? Both are very good, but the china has run short, and after such vigorous exercise as you have had, you must need refreshment." "I'm sure I do," said Randall, bowing before Emily with a great blue platter laden with two donuts, two wedges of pumpkin pie, and two spoons.
The smile with which she welcomed him, the alacrity with which she made room beside her, and seemed to enjoy the supper he brought, was so soothing to his ruffled spirit that he soon began to feel that there is no friend like an old friend, that it would not be difficult to name a sweet woman who would take him in hand and would make him happy if he cared to ask her. And he began to think he would, by and by. It was so pleasant to sit in that green corner with waves of crimson brocade flowing over his feet and a fine face softening beautifully under his eyes. The supper was not romantic, but the situation was, and Emily found that pie ambrosial food eaten with the man she loved,
whose eyes talked more eloquently than the tongue, just then busy with a donut. Ruth kept away, but glanced at them as she served her company, and her own happy experience helped her to see that all was going well in that quarter. Saul and Sophie emerged from the back entry with shining countenances, but carefully avoided each other for the rest of the evening. No one observed this but Aunt Plummy from the recesses of her pantry, and she folded her hands as if well content, as she murmured fervently over a pan full of crullers, "Bless the dears, now I can die happy." Everyone thought Sophie's old-fashioned dress immensely becoming, and several of his former men said to Saul with blunt admiration, "Major, you look tonight as you used to after we'd gained a big battle."
"I feel as if I had," answered the splendid major, with eyes much brighter than his buttons, and a heart under them infinitely prouder than when he was promoted on the field of honor, for his Waterloo was won. There was more dancing, followed by games, in which Aunt Plummy shone preeminent, for the supper was off her mind, and she could enjoy herself. There were shouts of merriment as the blithe old lady twirled the platter, hunted the squirrel, and went to Jerusalem like a girl of 16. Her cap in a ruinous condition, and every seam of the purple dress straining like sails in a gale. It was great fun, but at midnight it came to an end, and the young folks, still bubbling over with innocent jollity, went jingling away along the snowy hills, unanimously pronouncing Mrs. Bassett's party the best of the season. "Never had such a good time in my life!" exclaimed Sophie, as the family stood together in the kitchen where the candles among the wreaths were going out, and the floor was strewn with wrecks of past joy.
"I'm proper glad, dear. Now you all go to bed, and lay as late as you like tomorrow. I'm so kinder worked up I couldn't sleep. So Saul and me will put things to rights without a mite of noise to disturb you."
And Aunt Plummy sent them off with a smile that was a benediction, Sophie thought.
"That dear old soul speaks as if midnight was an unheard-of hour for Christians to be up. What would she say if she knew how we seldom go to bed till dawn in the ball season? I'm so wide awake, I've half a mind to pack a little. Randall must go at 2, he says, and we shall want his escort," said Emily, as the girls laid away their brocades in the press in Sophie's room. "I'm not going. Aunt can't spare me, and there is nothing to go for yet," answered Sophie, beginning to take the white chrysanthemums out of her pretty hair.
"My dear child, you will die of ennui up here. Very nice for a week or so, but frightful for a winter. We are going to be very gay, and cannot get on without you," cried Emily, dismayed at the suggestion.
"You will have to, for I'm not coming. I am very happy here, and so tired of the frivolous life I lead in town, that I have decided to try a better one."
And Sophie's mirror reflected a face full of the sweetest content.
"Have you lost your mind, experienced religion, or any other dreadful thing? You always were odd, but this last freak is the strangest of all. What will your guardian say, and the world?"
added Emily, in the awe-stricken tone of one who stood in fear of the omnipotent Mrs. Grundy.
"Guardy will be glad to be rid of me, and I don't care that for the world," cried Sophie, snapping her fingers with a joyful sort of recklessness which completed Emily's bewilderment.
"But, Mr. Hammond, are you going to throw away millions
lose your chance of making the best match in the city, and driving the girls of our set out of their wits with envy?"
Sophie laughed at her friend's despairing cry, and turning round said quietly, "I wrote to Mr. Hammond last night, and this evening received my reward for being an honest girl. Saul and I are to be married in the spring when Ruth is." Emily fell prone upon the bed, as if the announcement was too much for her, but was up again in an instant to declare with prophetic solemnity,
"I knew something was going on, but hoped to get you away before you were lost. Sophie, you will repent. Be warned and forget this sad delusion."
"Too late for that. The pang I suffered yesterday when I thought Saul was dead showed me how well I loved him. Tonight he asked me to stay, and no power in the world can part us. Oh, Emily, it is all so sweet, so beautiful, that everything is possible. And I know I shall be happy in this dear old home, full of love and peace and honest hearts. I only hope you may find as true and tender a man to live for as my Saul." Sophie's face was more eloquent than her fervent words, and Emily beautifully illustrated the inconsistency of her sex by suddenly embracing her friend, with the incoherent exclamation,
"I think I have, dear. Your brave Saul is worth a dozen old Hammonds, and I do believe you are right."
It is unnecessary to tell how, as if drawn by the irresistible magic of sympathy, Ruth and her mother crept in one by one to join the midnight conference and add their smiles and tears, tender hopes and proud delight to the joys of that memorable hour. Nor how Saul, unable to sleep, mounted guard below, and meeting Randall prowling down to soothe his nerves with a surreptitious cigar, found it impossible to help confiding to his attentive ear the happiness that would break bounds and overflow in unusual eloquence. Peace fell upon the old house at last, and all slept as if some magic herb had touched their eyelids, bringing blissful dreams and a glad awakening.
"Can't we persuade you to come with us, Miss Sophie?" asked Randall next day, as they made their adieu.
"I'm under orders now, and dare not disobey my superior officer," answered Sophie, handing her major his driving gloves, with a look which plainly showed that she had joined the great army of devoted women who enlist for life and ask no pay but love.
"I shall depend on being invited to your wedding, then, and yours too, Miss Ruth," added Randall, shaking hands with the little baggage, as if he had quite forgiven her mockery and forgotten his own brief lapse into sentiment. Before she could reply, Aunt Plumy said, in a tone of calm conviction that made them all laugh, and some of them look conscious,
"Spring is a good time for weddings, and I shouldn't wonder if there was quite a number."
"Nor I," and Saul and Sophie smiled at one another as they saw how carefully Randall arranged Emily's wraps. Then, with kisses, thanks, and all the good wishes that happy hearts could imagine, the guests drove away to remember long and gratefully that pleasant country Christmas. End of Part 4. End of A Country Christmas by Louisa May Alcott.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.